The Life of Jesus by Brother Melba Purkis. Book 3, Chapter 4, Galilee. Leaving Sychar, Jesus went northward into Galilee with his little band. The desolate expanses of rock and shrub they had left behind in Judea were forgotten as they reached their own fragrant countryside and heard once more the pleasant accents of their countrymen. The disciples' thoughts began to turn towards their lakeside homes, the families waiting for them, the gleaming lake and the nets. Jesus had made no demands of them yet, and they did not know that soon this dear familiar background must fade almost completely from their lives. But he had been quietly preparing them, and now the last stage of that preparation was at hand. As he parted from them, probably for several months, leaving them alone with their families, their nets, and their thoughts. They'd have plenty of time during the coming months to make their decision. In their homes and at their work, their thoughts would continually go back to the Jordan Valley, to Jerusalem, and to Samaria. They would hear their countrymen earnestly discussing this Nazareth carpenter who'd caused such consternation in the temple and shown such miraculous powers of healing in the city. Their minds would inevitably return to Jesus, and they would feel his compelling power in his very absence. There would be a feeling of futility in the daily tasks that in the past had always been so satisfying. They would long with an ever-growing yearning to see his face again, to hear his voice, to be with him. They would wonder what he was doing at that moment, whether he was near the lake or away in the northern hills. And they were slowly coming to realise that they could not live without him. When he came back to them, a word would be all that was necessary to cause them to follow him, whithersoever he'd lead. Meanwhile, Jesus made his way back to his own country. He came to Nazareth, a town that had become strangely remote, its traders still noisily busy in the narrow streets, the neighbours working and talking, grumbling and suffering as they'd done for the past 100 years or more. From Nazareth, he turned northeast to Cana, where he probably stayed with Nathanael, instructing him further in the deep things of the kingdom. A warm welcome would be waiting for him at the house of the young married couple, whose wedding he had attended nearly 12 months before. The attitude of the people was quite different now. News of his authority and power had been brought back from Jerusalem by those from the towns and villages of Galilee who'd attended the feast. They received him with reverence and watched him in expectation, and nor were they disappointed, because it was while he was at Cana that he received a visit from a high official of Herod's court who was in great personal distress. His son lay at the point of death. Hearing that Jesus had returned from Judea, he travelled the 25 miles which separated Capernaum from Cana, and finding Jesus, besought him to return with him to heal his son. In view of the man's obvious faith shown by his making the arduous journey, the reply of Jesus must have sounded strange. Except you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. But Jesus was going to use the occasion to bring greater blessings than the restoration of a dying boy. He was about to show the nobleman that the power of God vested in him did not need his actual presence at the scene of its ministry. There was no necessity to see the signs and wonders. Jesus may have been speaking to the nobleman near the fig tree in the garden where Nathanael had learned this lesson. The other apostles had yet to learn it. The countless company of disciples that have followed have had to understand that the power of Christ does not depend upon his physical presence. Herod's officer had shown a strong yet an imperfect faith in coming to Cana. Jesus sought to perfect it. For the moment, the man's distress clouded his perception. "Sir," he cried, "come down ere my child die." Then Jesus made his meaning clearer by relating it to the man's personal trouble. "Go thy way, thy son liveth." There could be no doubt now, and looking steadily at Jesus, the man believed his word. Yet his faith was to be tried still further. It was impossible to start back for Capernaum in the growing dusk, and he had to find an inn to spend a night filled with visions of the fever-ridden child he'd left, flushed and restless on his pallet at Capernaum, and the quiet, confident rabbi here in Cana. At the first glimmer of dawn, he'd be on the road again, his newfound faith still keeping his fears at bay. A company of men were coming towards him, and suddenly he recognized one, and then another. They were household servants. He was not kept in suspense much longer. First their movements and then their faces revealed the good news that brought them to meet their master. "Thy son liveth," and so his faith was vindicated. One thing remained, but the nobleman had little doubt what the answer would be when he asked his servants the hour when the change took place. It was the hour at which Jesus had spoken. The divine purpose was accomplished. The man believed, and his whole house. With a word, Jesus had saved more than the single life that was ebbing away in the quiet house at Capernaum. It was quite possible that the nobleman was Chusa, Herod's steward, and his wife Joanna, who showed her gratitude by joining the company of women who ministered unto Jesus of their substance. During the weeks that followed, Jesus remained in Galilee. From the absence of any record of his actions, it would appear that he spent the time in retirement. John was still preaching in Judea, preparing the people to receive their Messiah. The disciples now returned to their daily tasks, were, all unknown to them, being prepared for the moment when their Lord would demand their complete surrender. Jesus could accept the last opportunity which would be afforded him to rest in the quiet seclusion of the Galilean hills until the next feast at Jerusalem called him forth to unceasing labour. We may perhaps pause for a few moments to look at this pleasant Galilean countryside where Jesus spent these quiet months, the scene of the greater part of his ministry. It's difficult to imagine a greater contrast than that between Judea and Galilee. The former was for the most part bare and forbidding mountainous without the grandeur which can so often be associated with mountains. Apart from the cultivated terraces around its towns and villages, it was almost devoid of trees and vegetation, a land of hot, dry rock and scrub, stretching from the mountains of Samaria in the north to the wilderness of Zin in the south, and from the coastal plain in the west to the Jordan Valley in the east. Galilee, on the other hand, was a beautiful country of hills and wide valleys, green fields and golden cornland. The reason for this startling difference in a country no larger than Wales was the great mountain range of Lebanon, which dominated Galilee in the north. From the snow-covered peaks of Lebanon and Hermon, there was a steady drop to the Sea of Galilee, which lay several 700 feet below sea level. The effect of this was that the waters flowed constantly down from the mountains, making Galilee a land of rushing streams, springs and wells. Its valleys were green and fruitful, and its plains rich and well watered. The hard-working people accepted these natural blessings. They cultivated the plains and planted vines and olive groves on the lower slopes of the valleys. They grew corn and kept oxen and sheep. They cut the timber from the wooded hills and took fish from the lake. It was a land open to the sun and the air, a land in which it was not difficult for any man to climb a height and rejoice in the creative power of God and praise his name. The great contrast between Judea and Galilee extended to the people. The Galileans were the true products of their countryside, vigorous, warm-hearted, not easily intimidated, headstrong to the point of rashness. It was in Galilee that the Romans had most of their disturbances. Many times the hot blood would surge, Roman soldiers would march, and Galilean patriots would pay the penalty of their impetuousness unflinchingly. It's interesting to notice that although there was such a mixed population in Galilee, the Galilean Jews kept largely to their own cities. Jesus did not often go to the cities of the Gentiles in Galilee, and there's no evidence in the Gospels that he ever visited Tiberias, although he was constantly in its vicinity. Nor do we read that he went to Sepphoris, which was only 5 miles from Nazareth, and lay on the road to Cana. Tiberias and Sepphoris were the two most important towns in Galilee, but they were Gentile strongholds. No reference to Galilee would be complete without mention of its roads. Every valley was a natural highway worn by the dusty feet of merchants, travellers and pilgrims. Some roads even struggled down from the Lebanon mountain passes, trodden by those who preferred the perils of the land to the perils of the sea. Most famous of all these roads was the one which Isaiah called the Way of the Sea, connecting Damascus with ports of the Mediterranean Sea. And it carried not only the merchandise of Syria, but connected the countries of the East with Europe. Recognizing its importance, the Romans paved it and exacted a tax on its traffic. One of the taxing points was Capernaum, and one of the tax gatherers there was Matthew, waiting even now for the corn of Jesus. It was in this beautiful part of the Holy Land, amongst these busy, warm-hearted people, that Jesus spent the longest and happiest part of his ministry. With the sad exception of the people of his own town, he largely won their affection and loyalty. And although serious attempts were made from Judea to loose the hold he had on the Galileans, attempts which closed the doors of the synagogues against him, they did not really succeed, and many of the people remained faithful to the end. Thoughtful readings of the Gospels will convince us that as the hostility of the Jews intensified at the end of Christ's mortal life, Galilean hands strewed palm trees along the road to Jerusalem, and Galilean voices cried, "Hosanna to the Son of David! Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord!" Earlier they'd unsuccessfully tried to take him by force and make him king, but now they felt their hopes were to be realised. And though by his subsequent actions Jesus frustrated them, they remained faithful throughout the last dark week. The people whom the temple authorities feared when they attempted to arrest him on at least three of their days were not the reserved, law-ridden Jews of the city, but the people who'd come down from Galilee to the Passover. It was their presence which caused Caiaphas to take Jesus in the middle of the night, rush through the Jewish trial in the early hours of the morning, and get him condemned by Pilate before they realised what had happened. We do not know how long Jesus enjoyed the quietness of the Galilean hills, because we can only assume by vague indications which feast it was which Jesus attended in Jerusalem. It could not have been less than 3 months, nor more than 9. But with the disciples now ready for the supreme surrender of apostleship, with the net closing relentlessly around John in the desert, Jesus turned southwards once more and began the active phase of his ministry, from which there was to be no respite and no turning back.